include the effects of burning and dispersants. If our English was poor, I apologize, sir.
Well, okay. On page 355 of the same plan, it says, when you're talking about where the oil will go, it says...
include the effects of burning and dispersants. If our English was poor, I apologize, sir.
Well, okay. On page 355 of the same plan, it says, when you're talking about where the oil will go, it says, although it's unlikely oil will reach Main Bay, as a precaution, the fish hatchery will be boomed immediately. Did that happen?
It was boomed, and let me ask somebody here who's on the, can you answer that question about the booming of the fish hatchery?
Salmon Gulch.
Yeah.
The Solomon Gulch hatchery was not boomed immediately, both due to its location and the location of the spill, but ultimately boom was provided for the Solomon Gulch hatchery and Boulder Bay, which was a potential release site, some days later.
Okay, so the word immediately was inappropriate in the plan. We should have just said will be boomed, if possible, at some point. My understanding is the booms that the fishermen basically had to either rebuild or build some of their own booms because they couldn't hold up in the wave conditions and the winds that existed. Is that true?
The booms you really had to discuss that with Exxon, sir, because they were involved in that part of it. We were not involved with that part of it.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Sir, I just have
a couple of questions here. Under what authority did you transfer the responsibility of the cleanup to Exxon?
Well, there was no authority transfer required in the plan. They, in the plan, it says we will function, and I can't remember. It's like page
maybe I can read
1-3. Okay. Okay.
Maybe Mr. O'Donnell can help us with this too. The terminal superintendent is responsible to the Alyeska Oil Spill Coordinator and has authority and responsibility for all actions under this contingency plan?
And that's true until we transfer them to the owner company. In another place in the book
where
we talk about...
Could you find that in the plan, the transfer authority?
There's a statement in there that says that the spill cleanup will be conducted by Alyeska as an agent for the owner companies.
Just if you could just refer to the plan, I'd be...
I'm sorry, are you talking immediate response? Or are you talking about the long term? Maybe I misunderstood.
This is your plan.
Okay, immediate response.
Just where is it in the plan? Where is that authority to transfer this responsibility in your plan?
It's not specified in the plan. Exxon filed a plan with the state that says, and then they're required to, that says if the spill is above a certain size, and I think it's 250 barrels, they will come in and take over the spill and continue the plan, the Prince William Sound plan, plus whatever else is necessary to meet the challenge.
And
that was exercised, that whole transfer operation was exercised with ARCO in May of 88, so everybody would know that. The city would know it, the Coast Guard would know it.
So are you suggesting that when Exxon came on the scene, it relieved Alyeska of any responsibility?
It was Exxon's responsibility for the cleanup, and when they came on scene, they said, this is our responsibility. It's our oil. It's our responsibility.
So I need a yes or no answer. When Exxon came on the scene, did it relieve Alyeska of all responsibility for actions under the contingency plan?
It required that we continue to work with them and transition to where they then had control. We didn't drop it right away.
Let's try it all over again. I'm going to try a third time. Boy, this is simple. Let's really do this in a yes or no, because I think it's capable of being answered that way. When Exxon came on the scene, are you suggesting that relieved Alyeska of all responsibility under this contingency plan?
I believe that could very well be a legal question, sir. I'm not sure that I can answer that one in a clear sense.
Well, your lawyer's next to you. Why don't you ask him to point it out?
Mr. Durbin.
Yeah. Hey, wait a minute. Excuse me. The lawyer's not sworn in, I don't believe.
I'm perfectly happy to assist the committee with a purely legal comment if the committee wants it. I fully understand that I'm not a witness, and I do not intend to act as a witness.
To the members and to the witnesses, this cuts both ways. We've told them that their attorney is here to advise them on their constitutional rights, not to provide them technical help. If we want to lay down those rules, that's a different set of rules, and they were brought here. So if the witness cannot answer the question, either we can get that information at a later date or on a different set, but I don't want to change the rules in midstream here because it cuts both ways here.
This is part of the potted palm scenario, which we've been following in Washington. But could you tell me, sir, do you know whether there is anything within this plan which relieves Alyeska of liability once Exxon is brought on board?
That's the same issue, as far as I'm concerned, relating to liability. And I'd prefer not to answer that question. Leave that to be decided by the individuals in courts.
Well, then let me make the question much simpler. Is there anything in the plan which your company wrote which spells out this scenario? What happens to the responsibility and liability of Alyeska once they turned it over to Exxon? Is there anything in this plan? Now, that is a factual question. That's not a legal question.
I don't know of anything that deals with what happened, the transfer in specifics, no. The transfer was based on the plan, the fact that Exxon had their plan filed that said they would take over, and the fact they are the spiller and they are responsible for the cleanup.
And they sent you a copy of this plan that they filed with the state of Alaska, is that correct?
Yes, we have a copy of it.
And is it your testimony then that you, Alyeska, was prepared to turn over cleanup responsibilities to any company which had filed a plan with the state?
If they came in and took over the operation, then
no,
yeah.
No. Follow me here. You started off with the responsibility. You make the decision whether you hand it over. And I'm asking you whether or not you used any criterion other than the fact that the company asking to take over cleanup responsibility had filed a plan with the state.
Exxon, there was no question that Exxon had the capability to do it.
Well, you're not answering my question, sir. Do you use any other criteria? For instance, there are many companies which are not part of the ownership of Alyeska which do business with your terminal. Is that not true?
Well, that's correct.
And I assume that, God forbid, this could happen to some other company that's not part of the ownership of Alyeska. Is that, I guess that's a possibility, is it not?
And we would continue our initial response capabilities and activities until we had someone that we could hand it off to legitimately. If they didn't show up to take it over, we would have to continue doing the work.
So the question is whether they showed up. Is that what you're saying?
In this case, Exxon did with a plan, and they came in and took over. If the company had not shown up, we would have continued doing the cleanup work.
And you will not tell me whether that relieved Alyeska of liability because you think that's a legal conclusion?
I think it is. I'm not in a position to answer that.
Well, then let me ask you, was there any discussion at the Valdez terminal by Alyeska officials concerning this legal question when Exxon appeared on the scene at 1800 hours?
Not at all. There's no question that Exxon had the plan and had said they would be on site to take over. And they marshaled the resources to go at it.
You didn't even sit down with the other folks at Alyeska and decide whether that was the appropriate thing to do. As soon as they showed up, you handed them this cleanup responsibility.
Well, we had seen their plan. We knew they had a strike force in place. They had competent people to do the job. It's not like we never had talked to these people before. They knew what we could do. We knew we had a good idea what they could do, and they came in and took it over.
And they were to use
your takeover.
And they were to use your equipment, Alyeska's equipment.
That's correct. Until they could replace it, or otherwise they could continue using it. That's correct.
And how many barrels a day did they suggest they would be able to clean up under their plan?
I don't recall, and I don't think that it addressed it, did it? No.
You handed this cleanup project to Exxon without any knowledge as to what capacity they had to clean up the oil?
Their plan said that they would come in and follow through essentially on what was, they referenced the Prince William Sound oil spill contingency plan, the one you have, and essentially they just moved in and were taking over to try to fulfill the obligations laid out in the plan.
In other words, they were going to assume the responsibilities of your plan. Is that what you're saying?
They would carry it through, yes.
Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. I don't think we're going to keep you here too much longer, gentlemen, but let me ask you a couple of questions. Just to follow up on the notion, Mr. Durbin.
Representative Miller is now speaking.
Exxon had not chosen to step in to this spill. Let's assume their attorneys told them, for whatever reason, to stay away. This is why we created Alyeska. They're on the contingency plan. They run with the ball. What happens in that scenario?
Well, as I said earlier, we make the initial response. We will continue pursuing it just as aggressively as we can. And I guess if they did not show up, then we would have to just carry right on through and follow through with the obligations of the plan.
Exxon has some 300 people in here. You would be able to, you would have been able to find 300 individuals. Some of them are, you know, fairly high corporate positions and responsibilities and decision-making capability. You had been able to staff up to that extent?
We could have drawn on the people we have throughout our entire Alyeska organization. We would have contracted out and brought in a lot of experts that we know around the country who are capable of helping in this kind of process, and we would have contracted up and we would have drawn on our entire organization.
Do you think that process would have been faster than Exxon's or slower than Exxon's?
I don't know, because theirs was fairly quick in bringing their people.
They were drawing within a single organization of people and talent that they're familiar with, know, and have the corporate ability to say, go to Alaska. Not everybody that gets that message is thrilled. So we're now talking about a much different operation. And I'm not going to pin you down. I'm just saying, is this an ad hoc arrangement you have with Exxon, or do you have this arrangement with every shipper?
Well, you mean that they could come in and take over? The arrangement is there, yes. They're responsible, and they can come
Arco,
in and take over.
So Arco, BP, Chevron, Everybody, they all simply have this, and they have referenced your contingency plan with the state, and they can step in.
That's best of my knowledge. I have not looked through all the plans, sir, but I believe so.
And foreign carriers?
I would guess, well, I'm not sure who that'd be. We haven't seen the plan from Amerata Hess, and I'm not sure that they have one filed. They have to file one with the state, but I'm not sure they've seen the ships file it. Okay.
The ships file?
Is that correct?
Give your best answer.
Best answer is that each ship has a plan, but I think.
Are we down to the
company. They file a plan that covers their ships that come into the harbor, is my understanding of it. Like Exxon has a plan filed that covers all their ships that come in. Arco would have a plan covering all their ships. And BP...
What if you have one ship?
Then you have one plan for one ship, then.
Does anybody look at your financial capabilities of stepping in the stead of Alyeska?
Well...
I mean, we know the registry of ships, and we know how corporations sponsor ships, and we know that somebody said they have a mailbox in Delaware or the Bahamas.
Well, as I said, sir, Alyeska, if no one steps forward under this plan, would continue carrying out
you
the plan.
Check if you check to see whether or not you're exposing your other partners to this arrangement?
Nope.
I mean, would Chevron be delighted to find out that A&K Shipping Company is out here with 200,000 barrels on the water and doesn't have the financial capability, and now it's going to fall on them as a partner of Alyeska?
No.
I've heard some of the partners say they think Exxon's expensive.
Well, I'm sorry, could you repeat that, sir?
We've now gone from an agreement with Exxon. Mm-hmm. And then saying you believe that that's the case with the partners of Alyeska, Chevron, BP, and so now
Chevron's
that each ship has an agreement. And you're not going to have to answer this question. I'm just wondering, does this now open up the possibility that is a ship bonded? Is it not bonded? A ship comes in and takes a million barrels of oil out of here and runs aground. If that ship can't take care of it, you're telling us Alyeska comes in, right? Because that's... You're not telling me that. You're
traffic through the sign.
But my point is this. Some people have suggested already that this thing's going to be $500 million or more. You got a fund over there of $100 million. You start to see what worries me now? I mean, in one way, I guess you're happy that it's Exxon and not somebody else. We'll go in that to a later date. We're not done, unfortunately, with the operations here. But it raises some concerns, and maybe there's a simple answer and everybody's bonded and everybody's protected. Have you ever done a drill outside of the immediate vicinity of the Port of Valdez? Have you done one down 50 miles away?
Not to my knowledge, I'll ask. But I don't
30 miles, Mr. Shire?
We've done towing exercises where we latch on to a ship that simulate a ship in trouble where it's loaded with water and would drift. We've done those drills, and they've been done out there. But as far as the drills with oil spill response equipment and so forth, it's generally done within the Narrows for safety reasons.
Well, let's assume that oranges are relatively safe. Have you thrown out a lot of oranges out there in the wide straits and tried to see if you could round them all up?
No, as I said, the drills that we've run with our oil spill equipment have been inside the Narrows. We've not gone outside the Narrows except for the drill of the tow exercise on a ship that would go adrift.
Let me read you something. We used to have a gentleman who worked at your facility. His name was James Whittle. And he was the Marine superintendent for your facility for a couple of years. Prior to that, he was the commanding officer and the captain of the port for the United States Coast Guard in Valdez. He was executive officer on a cutter for a number of years in the Coast Guard, and he was also, I see, a member of the city council here. He wrote a letter in April 15th, 1984, I believe, to Mr. Nelson, and I think it was copied to the partners, the Marine Committee. You have a Marine Committee, is that right?
I have a Marine Subcommittee,
yeah.
Yes.
And in on that letter on page 2, he has, I think, now been fired by you, and he's saying to people that the following comments are offered as they refer to the operations pertaining to the Marine Department, Alyeska Marine Terminal situation. He says, point number 5 that he makes, because some of his points aren't directly related to this, he says, an oil spill recovery. Due to the reduction in manning, age of equipment, limited training opportunities, and the lack of experienced coordination personnel, serious doubts exist that Alyeska would be able to contain and clean up effectively a medium or large size oil spill. Recent manning reductions have affected all operating areas, while efforts to cut costs have limited the purchase of new oil spill recovery equipment. It was proposed that the oil spill personnel be sent to oil spills of opportunity in Alaska and or on the West Coast to gain hands-on experience in spill recovery operations. Though approved in theory, approval to send personnel was not granted. The present oil spill coordinator lacks both experience and training. Attempts to provide formal training and experience were disapproved due to cost. Response to any spill beyond the limits of the Valdez Narrows should not be attempted with present equipment or personnel. Should the availability of the MK contract personnel be terminated, an immediate plan for recall of Alyeska personnel in the event of an oil spill should be formulated along with the contingency plan for community personnel. That's a pretty rough statement for a guy who's had a fair amount of authority and experience and understanding the operations here.
I think was that after he'd been fired?
That's correct.
I haven't seen the letter.
That's after he'd been fired.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, he's entitled to his opinion in those areas. I do know that in the last 3 years that we've spent the money, we've trained our people, we've created a very, very strong, proud response team. And I'm just not familiar with that. I haven't seen the letter, and I'm not familiar with Mr. Whittle.
Well, you know, I think you can dismiss it as a letter in a man's opinion, except that he was deeply involved in the operations of this port for a considerable period of time. And he makes a recommendation in 1984 that maybe you dismissed as somebody we ought not to listen to because we made a decision to fire him, except he sort of forecast the problem in
in terms of the ability to respond outside of the Narrows, and coupled with the fact that you had never done any training or drilling beyond the harbor. Well, that's back to the notion of urgency that you had about this mission, which is part of the responsibility of moving 2 million barrels a day of oil through this through this system.
Well, earlier I tried to make it very clear the intense effort we've spent in training our people and having a full staff, in other words, the whole 120 people are part of this process. They're here to help us fight oil spills far better than the four-man crew that we had at that time, which were contract. And I've been through that, and I have not changed my feeling about that. We have a better crew, a better system than we had 4 years ago or whenever that was done.
Shannon, what's your opinion, Mr. Woodall?
Well, of course, I wasn't involved. I never did supervise Mr. Woodall. I did hire him. But I left the terminal about the time, and shortly before he came to work the terminal. I'm not familiar with any of the details about and that aspect of it, so I don't know what to tell you.
Ivan Hinman of Alyeska. George Miller of California is conducting the question.
Well, no, there's this whole series of documents and statements. You mentioned earlier that the fact that the barge was damaged has not caused a delay or interrupted the process. And one of your releases says on March 27th that we then had to prepare our oil spill barge, which was in repair since the recent storm in Valdez, which was January. This caused delay in getting out our equipment to support the site by 6 or 7 hours, which I think was the point that Mr. Owens raised. You apparently decided you needed a replacement barge. You went on a search and found one in the Gulf of, I think the Gulf of Mexico. May be wrong, the Gulf of Mexico. In April 18th, the Betty K that was going to be brought here for temporary stores, transport, and collection in a spill and a staging point for oil spill operations. It took you a year.
Yes, that was a very interesting exercise. We ran into a lot of trouble with the Jones Act. The problem is that we had to get approval of MARAD so the Coast Guard could certify it, and because BP is one of the owners of Alyeska, it took a lot of time to get that done. Otherwise, we would have had that barge here before the end of 1988, and things, my life would have been a lot simpler during the period. Sir.
So when did you get those licenses?
We got it late in the year, and we missed then the shipping window, because if you don't ship that barge before winter sets in the Gulf of Alaska, the tugs will not pull it across. You can't transit the Gulf of Alaska. We lost. It got to be too late in the year, and then we couldn't ship it.
You got those permits in October?
Something
November.
Like that, but we could not get it shipped, and we tried very much because we had to go through the Panama Canal and get up here. It got to Seattle too late, and it held over in Seattle.
And the delay, your testimony is that it was
related to getting the corrective work done on it and the approval of the Coast Guard and MARAD approval as far as the getting everything in line.
That had to be done before you moved it out of the Gulf Coast.
We wanted it certified. We wanted to be sure that it was certified by the Coast Guard to be used up here.
Because you were what? You were buying it from another party? I mean, it was already, you weren't building this barge, you were buying a barge in the open
second-hand
market.
Barge, we had to get it certified, it was useful for this service up here.
All right. Let me go again to, and you can comment on this also, on another document, which is a review in March of 88 from Judith Brendel, I guess. And she cites, she says, the oil spill equipment appears to be in good shape with the following exceptions. Only two light plants could be located on site. 25 feet of the 6-inch suction hose was not there. It has to be reordered. You were short 3,700 feet of containment boom. I guess you're going to order another 1,500 feet. You're short 8 of the 10 required blinker barricades. She goes on through this whole question and says, but your people have done a good job.
That was when, 88, sir? I'm sorry, the date of that was?
March 17th, 88.
Okay. I'm sorry, your question is? What?
Well, I'm just wondering how you keep this, how you keep the system, you keep the system current.
Well, we do an inventory every 6 months to make sure that all the pieces are there. It's kept in, most of this equipment that she's talking about would be in covered storage, and it's inventoried every 6 months to make sure it's there.
Not to do it.
It's what?
Oh, by Judith, yes. Yeah, I mean, it's done by the, but she was part of the environmental department, would come in and audit the operations group to make sure we had all the pieces there. Yes.
Okay. Well, I don't think we have any further questions at this time. Let me suggest that is not to suggest, speaking for myself, that I'm comfortable at all with the responses we've had with respect to our future reliance on this system. And that is a process that we will continue to go through. This committee is deeply involved in the issues of the Outer Continental Shelf, the questions of the North Slope of Alaska, the questions of the operation of your pipeline, the right-of-way agreement. And until that confidence is raised, it would be very difficult to suggest to our colleagues in the Congress that that any expansion of reliance on this oil spill capability, be it here, what we learned in Prince William Sound, or the notion that we can handle large spills because of statements made in other environmental documents and contingency plans, is just not it, because I think the most telling fact is the one that perhaps I think he's the president of Exxon, Mr. Stevens, made, and that is the contingency plan can't deal with a spill like this. Well, then the question is whether you put in operation a system that has the highest possible degree of preventative action, or whether you have any system at all. And I think that's the one that the country is clamoring for, is the notion that somehow this isn't repeated, whether it's 241 years, or whether it's next year, or whether it's this coast, or that coast, or this sound. I would say that confidence and is not there in the country, and that's part of this process. It's not just words on paper. It's not just thick documents. It's not just sound and light shows. It's the question of whether, in fact, assets are able to be deployed in a fashion that people have had their expectations raised to. And in this instance, I think that. As Mr. Kelso pointed out, there's a long history of resistance and opposition to the upgrading of this system by this entity and by your partners. But that's nothing new. That goes on in the San Francisco Bay Area and elsewhere. But I'm not sure that can continue if, in fact, you want to continue the privilege of, in this particular instance, of gaining public leases to move public resources, and to convert them, in effect, to private resources. So this is, we said this is the beginning of these hearings. But I think that until things are tied down in a much more concrete fashion, and I'm not kidding when I'm suggesting that the state not sign off on this agreement until you tell the people of this state the differences between what the factory tells you this equipment can do and what your real expectations are and the expectations you're prepared to stand by, because that is not the document that is presented in terms of a contingency plan in 77, in 80, in 88, and now in whatever new plan emerges from this disaster. That's not what's been. That's the confidence document. Well, the confidence has been shattered, and you better think of a new way of approaching this problem, because I just don't see that the Alaskan public or the American public is going to put up with it. And you are a very, very large player, you and your partners, very large players in this arrangement, and probably takes on commensurate responsibility. You're the leaders. You know, very often we divide people in Congress between mom and pop oil and major oils and independents and major oils and independents. We go back and forth. The theory is there's a group of people who are big enough, responsible enough, and accountable enough to play on the Outer Continental Shelf, to play in the ice fields, to go into the Arctic, to go out onto those frontiers, to go on the coast of California. That's the theory. We're the people with the capabilities and the responsibilities. I was here right after Santa Barbara. I rewrote the Outer Continental Shelf Act. And I always believed then that the last thing this industry ever wanted was another Santa Barbara. But when I see this kind of slipshod effort, I'm not so sure that I was quite correct. But that's the burden of proof that I think you have to overcome. And I'm going to tell that to Exxon, and I'll tell that to each and every witness representing this this industry. It is not enough for you to suggest that everything's okay because the state signed off on it. You know your responsibilities and you know the capabilities. And the question isn't whether or not you can get the state to sign off on five skimmers or four skimmers, or two escort boats, or one escort boat, or two tugs, or one tug, or two pilots, or one pilot. The question is, what should you sign off on as responsible members of the industry? That's the test. This isn't a bureaucratic game to whittle down the cost to such a fashion that you can get by and you can get the state to sign off. We're all politicians. We understand how bureaucratic agencies sign off. We understand people that are watching this cleanup effort. We're well aware of that. But if the political arena is going to decide all of those issues, and if the question of whether or not you have enough muscle to bring home the bacon to tell your partners, we're all right, we don't need that extra barge, we're saving $50,000 a year, or $100,000 a year, or $1 million a year. Figure out what 25% of the nation's oil is worth. Thank you. Any further statements? Committee stands adjourned. Until we're here tomorrow morning, 9 o'clock, I believe the witnesses are the Coast Guard and Exxon.
We just heard a closing statement and a indication of tomorrow's activities by Representative George Miller of California, chairman of the House Interior and Insular Affairs Committee Subcommittee on Power, Water, and Offshore Energy Resources. Participating in this committee hearing this afternoon and into the evening have also been Representative Wayne Owen, a Democrat of Utah, Representative Peter DeFazio of Oregon, not a member of this committee, but participating with this group, Representative Richard Durbin of Illinois. Fourth member of the subcommittee, Bruce Vento of Minnesota, will be joining the committee tomorrow. He is currently, or has been today, flying around the Katmai area and the Alaska Peninsula, assessing the extent of the oil spill in that area. At this afternoon's hearings, we heard originally testimony from John Devens, mayor of the city of Valdez, and then a panel of state witnesses led by Dennis Kelso, the commissioner of the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation, Frank Rue, the director of the Habitat Division of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, and also Larry Dietrich, who is the director of the Division of Environmental Quality, participated in some of that testimony. Following the state group, three representatives of CDFU, the Cordova District Fishermen United, spoke to the committee, Ken Adams, Jack Lamb, and Dr. Ricky Ott. And then the committee's deliberations this afternoon concluded with questioning, intense questioning for the last couple of hours, of a team of Alyeska personnel led by Theo Palasik, who is the Vice President of Operations, and Ivan Hinman, Vice President for Environment and Engineering. Peter Sarnacki, who is one of the Marine Supervisors at Alyeska, was also there. Sworn in also were Larry Shire and Chuck O'Donnell. The committee very aggressively pursuing questions about Alyeska and the plan and capabilities, and quite a stern admonition at the end by Chairman George Miller. Tomorrow on tap, so far as we know, we can expect early in the morning at 9 o'clock, Commander Steve McCall, who is the commander of the Coast Guard Detachment in Valdez, and in that role is the port captain of Port Valdez. And along with him will be Vice Admiral Clyde Robbins, who is the Coast Guard officer who has been appointed by Coast Guard Commandant Admiral Yost to be an overall Coast Guard command of the cleanup operation. Following the Coast Guard presentation, we expect to hear from Exxon. The two people that we know of who are scheduled to appear are Frank Iorossi, who is the president of Exxon Shipping, and Bill Stevens, who is the president of Exxon USA. For those stations down the line and listeners elsewhere in Alaska, elsewhere in the country, we will be broadcasting these hearings. They're scheduled to start at 9 a.m. And of course, for listeners in Prince William Sound, Valdez and Cordova, we'll be here at 9 local time and be on the air gavel to gavel with the committee's deliberations tomorrow. From the Valdez Civic Center Ballroom in Valdez, Alaska, that concludes this first of 2 days of hearings by the U.S. House Interior Subcommittee on Water, Power, and Offshore Energy Resources. For KCHU Radio, I'm Dave Hammack, and this is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.